Welcome everybody to Interviewing and Oral Histories with Suzanne Snyder, and you're listening to WGXC Online Radio, and we're going to turn things over in just a second to Suzanne. I don't know if you're ready yet, or should I? I could kill some time, or
we can start.
You can start.
Yeah.
Okay. This is Suzanne Snyder, and Interviewing and Oral Histories on WGXC Online Radio.
Thank you. Okay. Maybe I'll sit on the floor too. So I know several people in this room, but I just wanted to introduce myself, and then I thought we could go around and talk a little bit about what interests you about oral history, or maybe some projects you're thinking of, and then we can talk about your project ideas and interview approaches specifically. And if you don't have any ideas yet, that's fine too. But I just want to mention, as Tom said, I'm Suzanne Snyder, and I teach oral history in New York City, and I also consult a lot on oral history projects, from interview style to equipment, and do some of my own oral history projects. And I'm really interested in working with WGXC to figure out how we can use oral histories on the radio. So, oral history is a relatively new field, and what that means is that some of the rules I'm going to put out are flexible and you can break them, but I am going to put out in a purist sense some definitions of what oral history is and what the difference is between, let's say, an oral history interview and a journalistic interview. So we're going to talk about that. And the two sheets I handed out, what I thought we'd do is go around in a circle. And just if you want to mention your name and if you're interested in any particular oral history projects, mention that too. And then we can go from general to specific when we're going through this sheet. I thought we'd go through this workshop by talking about what oral histories are, why we might collect them, what we can do with them after we collect them, and then also do an exercise together. And there is a perfect size group to do that. So maybe we can start with you, Alex, if you don't mind just introducing yourself.
Okay. My name's Alex. I live at this farm, and I have some experience with doing interview projects, but I think I have a lot more to learn because I still can't concentrate on the technical aspects of recording at the same time as I'm trying to like keep a trusting and like, you know, well-developing communication with the subject. Mm-hmm. So I guess. I don't have any specific oral history project in mind right now.
Okay. Okay. No, that's great. That's helpful. Okay.
And I'm Erin. I just was curious about what people had to say or talk about with this particular thing. I guess my family all lives in rural Wisconsin, and I've just thought for a long time about, you know, talking with the older generations about the community and the family. Also live in Albany, and I've wanted to kind of talk with my neighbors just about the stoop culture of everybody just kind of sitting outside, and just the ways that they have interacted with each other over the years.
I'm Shelley. I don't have any particular question. I just kind of came along there to check it out. So.
Okay. I'm Tom, and I've never done any oral histories, but I have a long journalism background, so you're going to talk a little about the I'm interested to hear about the differences of journalism and oral histories, and then I have also a crazy sound art background, which is a... So I've got two opposite ends, and the middle is lacking.
Take notes and maybe not probably participate too much, but I'm interested in, from the radio station, what we can be doing in the listening area with our oral histories.
Great. My name is John, and I spend my weekends in Hudson, and for about 5 years, and I've seen how rapidly the city's been changing, and I've wanted to interview the generation that's going, that's you know, passing right now, because I think a lot of the history of the city is just being lost because there's not a lot of connection between the new people and the old people. And I have a blog, and my idea was to publish interviews on the blog.
Great. My name is Galen. I'm connected to the radio station. I'm the director of the arts organization that has the license. I guess I have a particular interest in oral histories, also related to this generation of people that's in the media arts world, in video arts specifically, that's kind of dying right now. And there's this project that the museum world is putting forth and has been putting forth for a while called Variable Media, and it's trying to figure out how to deal with some of these works from a collection standpoint. And there's all these interviews about how these works should be cared for in the future, and I think an oral history component would be a really smart addition to that process. So I guess that would be my personal interest.
Great. I feel like listening to everyone's ideas about projects, those of you who mentioned projects, you are representing the spectrum of reasons one might start an oral history project. Oral history is a process and a product. So journalism might be a means to an end, but oral history is very concerned with the process and the experience between two people. So an oral history project, for example, might be done by, say, people in this room who learn to interview, or an oral history project can be community-based and done by the people you want to interview. So for example, with your idea of stoop culture in Albany, one project design could be for you to interview people, another could be to get your neighbors interviewing each other. So the project design is very important, and we're going to talk about what oral histories are and also what an oral history project is. So very generally, we throw around this term and everyone's heard it, but in terms of what an oral history is, we're going to define it for the purpose of today as an oral interview that's full length rather than excerpted or produced. So when you hear an interview, let's say on the radio, and you hear an excerpt, it's not that that's not oral and it's an interview, but the oral history is the full document, untouched, unproduced, not excerpted. And I think that will help us make some distinctions. And a written transcript, which you might also see oral history at the heading, that's not an oral history. For the purposes of today, we're going to say that's the transcript for the oral history. But the oral history is always the full audio document. And that means it has the sort of juicy parts, the boring parts, the beginning, middle, and an end. And that progression's really important. So when you get interested in oral history, you're interested in what parts are slow, uncomfortable, what parts you feel like the interviewee is speaking anecdotally. You're really interested in the whole progression of the interview. And based on what everyone said in this room, we're sort of starting to make a list already of different kinds of oral history projects that exist. So I'm just going to throw out some categories, even though some projects might straddle a few categories. But an oral history project could be the story of a community. It could be the story of a social or political movement. It could be the story of an event. It can be a family history, which was also mentioned. It can be a life history, a particular person's story. So let's say a life history, an oral history project is to do a life history of a particular activist. That person might be interviewed up to 10 times, 2 hours at a time. A life history would be a series of interviews. I've also seen someone design a life history of someone who died by interviewing 10 people who knew this person. So you can be very innovative with design, which is what's very exciting about oral history. Even when you decide what you're doing, you get to figure out how you're going to do it. An oral history project might also be an institutional oral history. So for example, at Columbia, there's an oral history of the beginning of Sesame Street and Children's Television Workshop. It can be an oral history project about a particular workforce, let's say female journalists in the 50s. It can be an oral history project about a musical genre. So I know someone doing a project now about black metal musicians. And those are just some of the possibilities. So we have community histories, political histories, family histories, life histories, institutional histories, work histories, and music histories. And these are just some of the examples. So I've had students who did oral history projects on art handlers in New York. And basically, when you're thinking about why to choose, you know, a project, what your motive is, you want to think about what oral history is. And it's supposed to be history from the bottom up, which means it's supposed to be the voice of the people. And unlike some radio stations, which go to pundits, experts, or people with the most sensational stories, oral history wants to represent a range of experiences. So, for example, you know, after 9/11, you'd see television stations and radio stations go for the most extreme stories. Oral history projects want to represent a range. They want to find out the find the person who says, "I was sort of affected," versus the person who says their whole life changed. So oral history is really interested in representing accurately a range of experiences and also finding contradictions. So a lot of times the news, partly based on the business model, news will have to reconcile two people who disagree. So by the time it's produced into a radio documentary or a newspaper article, someone will have to make a decision. If three people say three different things, you'll have to reconcile those stories. Oral history, you can maintain all the contradictions, which I really love. So all the contradictions, you're looking for those, and those interviews get to live next to each other rather than, you know, being synthesized. So the idea of family history passing stories down, or the idea of saving stories in Hudson, this is another motive to pass stories down between generations or between phases of a place. To add voices that haven't been heard, amateurs as opposed to pundits, marginalized people, radicals, that's kind of where most oral history projects begin, is sort of whose voice has not been heard. And other reasons you might want to do an oral history project are to correct the record, to add to the record, or to galvanize community. So I just want to bring up one example, and then at any time if you have any questions or if you're thinking about a project and that these ideas, you know, inspire questions, go ahead and interrupt me. But I just want to bring up an example. In Brooklyn, there was a huge oil spill that affected people both in Queens and Brooklyn. And all the activism surrounding the oil spill was very separate in Brooklyn and Queens. So they generated an oral history project where people affected were interviewing each other. And the idea was not only to create a record, but also to unite these groups on both sides of the creek so that they could work more effectively. So an oral history project, again, is a process and might work to galvanize community and help with social networking. So in addition to the, are there any questions so far about any of this? No? Okay. So, in addition to a community-based project, another interesting project design is an oral history chain letter. And the design for an oral history chain letter is where one person goes out, and let's say I interview Alex, then I pass on the equipment, or Alex uses her own, and she'd interview Aaron. So that the idea is that one person is interviewing a person he or she knows, and the network is getting larger, wider, wider. Whereas if I sat down and tried to make a list, I'd be limited by my own social network. But if you're passing the equipment along or the sort of mandate along, then you're broadening your network. And so that's a really effective model for oral history projects as well. What I'd like to do is just now highlight some of the difference between an oral history interview and a journalistic interview, and then I thought we'd do an exercise which will help make all these things a little more concrete. So I made a list, and sorry the writing's so small, but under on the bottom of page one, there's a list under oral history, and I just wanted to highlight some of the, you know, 10 to 12 things that really distinguish oral history. And the things that are bolded are especially important. So I kind of covered number one, that oral history values all voices, particularly those that don't get heard. And then the second thing I want to mention, and this is so important, so if this is one of the three things you walk out remembering, open-ended questions are the cornerstone of oral history. And open-ended questions are questions that presume nothing, to the point where you don't even say, what did you dream last night? Because you're not sure if the person dreams. So the open-ended questions are something that distinguish oral history interviews from journalistic interviews. And we're going to practice some when we do the exercise. But when you begin an oral history interview, your whole goal is to get people to speak about things, to think while they're talking, instead of offering rehearsed memories or rehearsed thoughts. So we all have a bag of stories that maybe we've already told, or a group of favorite memories, or memories that we think tell our stories best. But what you want to get an interviewee doing is speaking anecdotally. And one of the ways you do this is by asking very open-ended questions where your interviewee cannot fail. So you don't ask a question where your interviewee can't have an answer. So, for example, asking a question at the very beginning of the interview, like, before we talk about, this particular, the beginning of this farm, I'd like to know a little more about you. Tell me about where you come from. Now, that might sound ridiculously vague, but what's beautiful about that question is that your interviewee right away is going to make a choice about how to approach that question. Where you come from can be answered in many ways. It can be the person can go off and talk about the town he or she comes from. The person might speak about his or her family. Or the person might talk about the values he or she grew up with. And right away, your interviewee is taking the lead. So, unlike a journalistic interview, you're giving up a lot of control. And basically, you come without any prepared questions. What you really need to know is what your favorite opening question is. And every oral historian kind of settles upon his or her favorite question. And I think, to begin with, tell me a little bit about where you come from is a great question. There's, the classic when you're getting your equipment, we're going to talk about equipment, when you're getting your equipment set up while you're doing a sound check, tell me what you ate for breakfast this morning. Another question that someone can't fail. The stakes are very low.
Do you have a certain technique for making people relax? I mean, you put a microphone in front of people and they tend to tense up and become nervous that they're going to say the wrong thing like you're talking about. You have a technique for that?
I think the sound check is really important because that's when the rapport begins. And I think that if you begin with a sound check where you're saying, tell me what you ate for breakfast this morning, you're establishing, you're losing a little bit of formality. When you do say, tell me where you come from, depending on your interviewee, someone might say, well, that's a huge question. What do you want to know? That's the very important moment when you assure your interviewee anything you want to tell me. When you acknowledge that you know it's a huge question and say you can begin anywhere. And that's basically the message you're supposed to be sending throughout. And I also like to talk the interviewee through the process. So I say on mic, we're going to do a sound check now. Why don't we start? You can tell me what you ate for breakfast. Then I let the tape run and say, what I'd like to do is have each of us introduce ourselves so that you do have the formal, my name is such and such, I was born in such and such. Then you begin with your open-ended question. And I think that rapport, and you'll see when we do the exercise, we're gonna do a brief exercise in groups of three. There's a beginning, middle, and end to every interview, but they're not necessarily proportionate. So the beginning breaks into the middle the second your interviewee stops worrying. And that can happen in minute two, or that can happen in minute seven, but it's so clear when it happens. And even in a short exercise, we can kind of experience that. So one thing, when people practice listening to interviews, I ask them to find the beginning and middle, and you always can. And it's a really beautiful moment. Sometimes you'll hear an interviewee say something like, oh, I never thought of that, after he or she speaks. So we'll talk about relaxing people, but the general idea is that if you give people questions that they cannot fail. You know, where do you come from? That's a great question. Or tell me an early, some people say, tell me about your earliest memory. Everyone has an earliest memory, no matter when it occurs. So that's one way to relax people. Yeah, Alex.
A lot of the interviewing I've done hasn't been in a, like, sitting face-to-face,
mm-hmm.
like, formal setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, I mean, I didn't study oral history, but is it always presumed that you are in kind of, like, a quiet, not part of, like, activity time? Like, because we did a lot of active sounds.
Yeah.
And that was our way of trying to find out, you know, trying to, like, give a portrait of a person?
That's a great question. It's a great distinction between radio and oral history because you aren't trying to capture ambient noise or establish a scene. In fact, you're allowing that person to detach from the present scene and give a broad story. It doesn't mean that it's not great when the dog barks or if someone calls and there's an interruption, but you ideally want to be in a quiet place. And I mean, I even wrote, this sounds ridiculous, but I really recommend a very specific physical setup, which I'll do a little imitation of momentarily. But I don't recommend sitting on a sofa because it seems fun for the first 5 minutes until you're both like this. So I have a setup that I always like to use at the corner of a table. And I just like to give the interviewee a heads up. Like, we're going to be looking for an hour and a half of time in a place you feel comfortable. And that way people, if it's convenient to do it at home, great. If the person doesn't want to show you his or her home, you find another place. Yeah, it's different in that you're not trying to capture all that extra information.
The reason I brought up is I was thinking how the beginning, middle, and end is very different when you're like at someone's job,
yeah.
Because then it like kind of switches back and forth depending on what they're doing, and sometimes when they're most honest is when they're busy doing something else, and they're just kind of narrating it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the equivalent in oral history would be that sometimes you shut off the microphone, and then someone starts telling you the most insane, wonderful story, and then you just turn the mic back on. But it's a little bit different. We're going to talk about what, you know, how oral history can be translated into radio documentary too. Because one question is, well, what do you do with oral history? So you gather all these interviews, but where does it live? You know, so people know what it is, but they don't understand what it is because where does it go? So I just want to answer that question briefly and say that, you know, you have a growing number of choices. When you compile oral histories, people are streaming them on websites. WGXC is a wonderful place to put local and area-related oral histories. They can be put into compilations that can be stored or archived at a public library or an institution that's relevant. But ideally, anyone you're taking from, you want to offer something back, and that's another cardinal rule with oral history, is that you should be able to formally answer the question, what does my interviewee get back from this? And that's something that ideally any documentarian asks, but we can all get a little lazy about that. And oral history really formalizes that question. As a practice, you should be able to answer in one sentence what your interviewee gets back. And you can give back in a number of ways. Some of the ways people have answered that questions is, let's say there was a project where a man interviewed a group of women who were involved in the Vietnam War and had never been interviewed, and none of them knew each other. So to give back, he created an event where the oral histories were shared, and there was actually like a social event created where people could meet one another. Giving back could be as simple, if you take a life history of someone, it'd be really nice to give that back so that person could have that for their own family. So giving back could be a number of things which we can talk about, and I'd be interested in your ideas. Has anyone had to deal with that issue of reciprocity and come up with something?
Well, I haven't done this, but in my head,
mm-hmm.
I would be bringing somebody flowers or a bottle of something. Is that too mechanical?
It can be material, but I don't want people to get into something where they feel like a gift upon entering someone's home. I mean, I have a rule where anyone over 60 years old, I just can't help but bring like cookies or something. But I don't, I still think that doesn't totally answer the question, because that's what we like to give, but is that what the person likes to get? And we'll never know. If you don't know your interviewee well, you'll never know what that person loves to get. But that's certainly, you know, a nice thing to do.
Yeah. They've more dealt with the question of, like, why do you want my story? You know, mm-hmm. and people, like, just not feeling like it's, like, relevant or, I don't know, and kind of, like, what's the power in my story? Like, where is it going? What are you going to be using this for?
This is, okay, this is a major issue, especially because ideally you're interviewing people who don't normally get interviewed. Ideally, you're interviewing people who no one maybe has cared what they want to say, or people have told them to be quiet, or they consider themselves very regular people who don't feel comfortable representing a particular group of people. Mm-hmm. The very reason people might be reluctant to talk is the very reason they're the most important people to talk. These are voices that haven't been heard. And I think when someone says, why me, or I'm not a good talker, you can say, would you be willing to try for an hour? Mm-hmm. But you should also, that's another question, you should be able to answer why you've selected this person. So I do like to say, you know, I'm especially interested in interviewing you because I think you have a lot to teach me about blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Or because I haven't had a chance to talk to you and hear your story. But you really do want to make that clear, and there still will be resistance. I think that's a really good point, and I have come across that. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of people who are reluctant to speak on microphone, you want to remind them this isn't live, and that they will have a chance to listen to it after you record it. I think a lot of anxiety can be resolved by explaining to someone before, during, and after what is happening. So I think one mistake people make is taking an interview from someone and disappearing. And I think if you're very clear during an interview and after about what will happen, that can really, you know, resolve those issues. So telling someone this will take about an hour and a half, it's not that that person blocks out the hour and a half, it's that someone can start to imagine what the experience might be like. I recommend approaching people by letter or email first rather than phone, so people have time to think about it. And if you are networking and someone you have a contact who gave you this, you know, person's name, mention that. Are there any other questions so far about some of these issues of reciprocity? Does anyone else?
What about paying people?
Okay, so paying people, and this is interesting because this comes up in journalism and is generally considered a huge no in journalism. That
did you read Bomb the Suburbs? You know that book?
No.
That book, he interviews graffiti writers, and he actually goes through this whole process that you're talking about. And you know, part of the graffiti writers, like, don't want to talk because it's illegal what they're doing. Part of it is, like, the kind of like the way people thought of photographs is like you're stealing their soul, kind of. He ends up like working out some sort of deal where, because he's writing a book, that the proceeds of the book kind of get split among the people he's interviewing. So it's along the same lines of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated in this ethical question, and I think we could talk about how journalists, people writing books and oral historians deal with it, and then I can give you a few exceptions. But in general, in journalism, it's considered a terrible idea because it can provide motive for people without money to say things in order to be paid. On the flip side, you have people who might not have a lot of money giving you time, but they need to make money, so there's a question of how to compensate. In journalism, I would say this, the overall decision has still been no, informants should not be paid. In the case of people writing books, people often buy people's, they buy life rights, essentially. So in the case of like a book like Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore, his life rights were purchased for something like $70,000.
What's a life right?
So a life
outright is when a subject of a book essentially is paid an agreed upon amount of money in order to be written about. And I think that one thing to keep in mind about interviewing people, and there are all kinds of legal releases that can go along with your oral history project, but I tend not to, write about someone if that person wants to write about him or herself. That's my personal role. But basically, this question of paying people, in oral history, the idea is also that you do not pay informants because you're setting up a really dangerous economy where people might be interviewed just for money, and you really want to have willing interviewees. I did have someone do a project about bottle redeemers who basically their main economy was picking up cans and bottles, taking them from New York to New Jersey, and getting the return, the increased return in New Jersey. And she felt like she was paying people, you know, this was subsistence living, and she paid them the amount they would make in that hour. And that was a decision she made after, you need to be able to articulate your methodology. So I think if you really feel like someone needs to be paid, how do you justify it and proceed? You know, but the general bent is no, not paying people. Are there any questions, or you guys want to talk about that?
Well, I have a, you know, this project that's proposed where I'd be working with people in marginalized communities, and I feel like, to me, the reciprocity is like there's some giving somebody a handout, like, here's $50, thanks, or this empowerment issue of having something that's like involving them in that process of the documentation or creating this, like, that has another kind of, to me, like, that sounds more valuable than whatever I, you know, like, check could cut them for 2 hours of their time or something. But
wait, what sounds more valuable, giving
that,
them?
That you had said something about giving people a sense of how they're participating,
yeah,
what they're participating in, how where that fits into the bigger picture, and then giving some kind of, I assume, so whatever kind of documentation or something that's appropriate for them that would make people feel connected to that, whatever that larger thing is, so
yeah,
that they're really buying into, like, be part of this larger thing,
yeah,
and not, like, thanks for the good time, honey, here's your $50.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But, we can follow up later, because I don't want to go off the rails of whatever other people have here, but I think that's an interesting, like, thing, especially for us as a radio station, to be thinking about how we could have, because we can have this really long-term commitment with this community, hopefully, like, if we start something on oral history, you know, maybe there'll be people 50 years from now, knock on,
mm-hmm,
would that might still be continuing that, or, you know, building that up.
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter the end result of where the history is going? I mean, most of these histories, there is no, if it's you're using it on the radio or putting it on a website, there's no commerce taking place where someone's getting rewarded and the interviewee is not getting rewarded. So does that play into it too?
I mean, I think if you're asking someone to be part of something, you want to make sure in the end that they feel part of something. So, for example, if you're trying to interview, you know, everyone who collects cans and bottles, and the only connection, you know, you're the one threading people together, and you're going to these different sites, if you want to make sure that they understand they're part of a larger culture, a larger movement, so how can you give that back? You don't want to be the only one making that connection. So whether that's playing the interview back with other interviews, creating a gathering, or, you know, putting these interviews in a place like a library, where you're expressing that their voices are important and need to be studied by other people, it really depends on the situation. I did want to bring up a case of a British oral historian who interviewed sex workers, and one kind of obvious form of reciprocity is to give the interviews back, the transcripts, and then allow people to make comments or add things. And she found that it was not a gift to give those transcripts back. Those were really not, that a lot of sex workers didn't want those in their homes.
And so again, you have to always think about the specific situation you're in. But I would love to keep talking. I mean, let's come back to reciprocity, because I think it's a great thing to troubleshoot with your own projects in mind. In terms of radio, you know, it's very rare that a radio station could play a full hour interview. It's not impossible, and it happens. But often radio wants to cut to the hot spot, let's say, in an interview. And if that's the case, you want to make sure the full interview is still available somewhere, maybe even at the radio station. Or maybe on the website, you can listen to the full interview here, only this excerpt will be broadcast. I think that's very important, though, because it's the full interview that is the oral history, again. So going back again to this list about open-ended questions, which we're going to practice, I want to just mention life history component. And I'm just going to give you an example, because it might seem obvious that everyone you interview, you ask them about themselves. It's not always obvious if you're interviewing around, let's say, a crisis. So one project that really converted me to the like oral history, an instance where I became very passionate about oral history, was interviewing after 9/11 on a project that was 3 years in scope. And rather than interview people in the moment of crisis and then leave them and say, thanks, here's the CD, we plan to interview the same people every year for 3 years. And the study was not just about what happened, but about what it means. And this is a huge difference, and I hope I'm not offending any journalists in the room, because I think a good journalist does this too, and a good radio person, but oral history is not interested in facts. Oral history is interested in meaning. So you're not just asking an interviewee what happened, you're asking an interviewee, what do you think that means? Why do you think that happened? What do you think is going to happen next? What would you like to see happen? It's entirely getting that person's subjective view, not just what did you witness. So in the case of the 9/11 interviews, we did ask people, what did you see? But we also asked people, what did you talk about? You know, tell me a story you heard from a friend. And then one of the most important questions was, what do you think is going to happen next? And people were astonishingly confident about what they thought was going to happen next. It was very different. And they'd answer, well, of course, blah, blah, blah. Then you'd interview someone else, and it was, of course, blah, 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 something else. We re-interviewed the same people a year later, and their memories had totally changed. We asked the exact same questions. And so the oral history project became a study of memory and trauma. And that's when I knew I loved oral history, because you can study not just what happened, but how do we tell stories and how do we remember things. So if I could give a little plug for oral history, one thing, if you're interested in memory and if you're interested in, I would say it's really a study of memory and meaning. And you never correct your interviewee, so this is another thing. I don't think a journalist has this luxury. If someone says 1850 instead of 1950, you never correct your interviewee. You never say, don't you mean 1950? You try and think about what's happening and why is this person saying 1850? You can always correct it later in the transcript. But you allow, it's not about facts, it's about meaning. Are there any questions about that or comments? So this life history component, I bring this up because when you are interviewing, let's say, you know, especially when there's a crisis, let's say 9/11, you go to interview someone, they want to launch right away into the story that of that day. And the problem is you're hoping to create a record for history. And you're hoping that like 20 years from now, 50 years from now, someone will listen to these interviews. But they're not going to be meaningful unless we have context. And context is, who are the interviewees? So it'll be more interesting if you hear someone say something, you know, if someone says something incredibly sexist, let's say. You want to know who that person is. How does that person identify him or herself? At the beginning of the interview, you want to give that person a chance to say, this is where I come from, this is what I do, this is how I got here. And then you get onto the subject of the interview. And so that should last about between 10 and 20 minutes, life history component. So So I guess, again, just to go over, so open-ended questions, life history component, and the life history component begins with these questions I mentioned before. Tell me a little bit about where you come from. And that's the part we're going to practice today, so I think we'll do that in a little bit. The life history component often can be introduced at the beginning of an interview. You say, before we get to the subject of 9/11, I'd like to know a little bit more about you. And then you ask the first open-ended question. The other thing that characterizes an oral history interview is a lot of silence. And this is really hard to practice, and sometimes you have to train yourself by counting to three very slowly. And you also have to practice active listening, like what Aaron's doing right now, nodding, because you don't want to hear yourself on the audio saying, which a lot of us do. So you practice nodding, and when someone tells you something, we're so obedient as a species that often we're waiting to be interrupted or waiting for someone to, we're very quick. And you want to give someone permission to expand or add something. So if someone tells me something, yeah, Tom.
Well, I was thinking one technique might, but it might be off-putting, is I'm wearing headphones right now, and it's much easier for me to be quiet because I'm like really hearing like what's going on. Is that a good technique? I mean, to wear headphones when you're doing it, or does that put people off?
I do like to wear headphones, and I meant to bring my headphones to show what I usually have headphones on one ear, and I say at the beginning, I'm like all for saying everything out loud to the point where I say, I'm going to have headphones on for this interview. I can hear you perfectly. I just want to make sure your story is recorded. Because it might seem rude to put on headphones, but you know what's really rude? Taking someone's story for 2 hours and be like, oops. I only hear the fan, you know, I always explain that, and I say, I might put them on a few times, and then I put them around my neck.
That would seem like it would help you to avoid those, all those noises you make without thinking about it because you're hearing them.
Exactly. I think having headphones on is good. I also, as soon as you transcribe your first interview, you'll be horrified when you hear how much your is on there. But also, what I do when someone's talking, often we'll trail off and wait for someone to interrupt us. I'll say, interesting, tell me more. Or, interesting, nod, nothing, wait. And often they will break the silence. It sounds manipulative, and to a degree it is, but you're manipulating someone to give you more. And you're also giving someone permission, and you're saying, I'm not done, I'm still with you. So sometimes someone will re-explain something again. If you say, tell me more, or explain that again, or just, interesting. I think what you're saying is, I'm still processing that. And that does, or I'm still listening. So silence is really, really important. You want to use the language of your interviewees. If there's a lot of memory stuff going on, and if they're counting in seasons, two falls ago, then you ask questions in terms of seasons. If they're saying my 25th birthday, what were you doing on your 30th birthday? So you're really, you're kind of, a lot of comparisons have been made between psychoanalysis and oral history, because you're like, what is my interviewee doing, and I'm going to follow him or her. And you're really, it's not what I like to do, it's what does my interviewee like to do. So calibrating time, the way your interviewee does, it's not to be polite, it's very effective. You'll be shocked. Okay, other things, do not pathologize. If someone's telling you about an experience that is obviously terrible, things we equate, with negative thoughts, feelings, like war, you don't want to pathologize the event. You want to make sure that the person can tell you some positive things that happened. People are often shy or reluctant to tell you that 9/11 was like a great day for them because they reunited with someone they hadn't spoken to in 5 years. So you want to make sure you ask a question, are there any experiences you haven't talked about yet that were positive? A lot of people say positive things about relationships during war. You want to make sure there's space for positive memories. Reciprocity we talked about, we'll still talk about. But the last thing I want to say is about you know, what should be contained in an oral history interview is problem solving. And I think you're really empowering your interviewee. If you are interviewing him or her, it's because you consider him or her an expert in something. You are the best person to tell me about life on this block in the 70s. You should really ask him or her what they want to see happen and what they think will happen. So problem solving is a great component. Other things, so, okay, so just going over this list, and we can, are people getting some of the differences between a journalistic interview? Are there any other questions about ways that you might interview if you've worked as a journalist or documentary filmmaker?
Yeah, there's some questions about reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way I was trained or like developed where, and it's very like deliberate. There's sometimes when the person you're interviewing, like it seems like they want to know something about you before they reach this like level, you know, where they feel comfortable. And it's like, it's a very uncomfortable mix between like intimacy and you're doling out pieces of information about yourself in order to like maintain this trust that they don't have any reason to believe that you deserve, you know, but they will believe that because it's like the way to get people to go deeper into their experience with you. But it sounds like with an oral history, you're really not going to say anything at all about yourself at all.
Well, that's a great question, and I'll tell you the argument for not revealing much about yourself. But then again, these are rules, and you're going to have to break them depending what your project is and what you think is appropriate. So sometimes when you give out information about yourself, and again, this is parallel to psychoanalysis, you're giving people cues about what your own values are.
Or what you'll understand that they're going to say.
Yeah. So you're creating, you might be inhibiting your interviewee, even though you might think it's making someone more comfortable. You're giving them an idea of where you stand in this landscape. And believe me, I mean, you're walking in and obviously giving all kinds of cues, even if you think you're not, the way you look, what you know, all kinds of superficial things. But, when I worked for the Oral History Archive at Columbia University, which is the oldest oral history archive actually in the country, and is connected to Columbia but also a separate entity, it was really a problem getting people to convey conservative political opinions. Because the second I said I was from a university, and so it really was a perfect object lesson for me that it can be generous to say things about yourself, but it can also be very generous to be like, this is your interview and I'm gonna say close to nothing. I'm gonna be here and you know, you can talk after the interview. But my personal experience has been that I like to say as little as possible. I know some people who are on the same 9/11 project who didn't feel like they could take testimony without offering something. I didn't feel that way, but there were a lot of people who did. I've also found that people are amazingly self-centered, and you think they're going to ask you all kinds of questions about yourself, but they don't often. But, you know, your experience maybe has been different when people do want to know where you're from.
I think it comes up more with, like, multiple interviews. Like, if you have, like, 40 hours with one person, it's like,
yeah,
you have to do some kind of calculus. Because
yes.
Even to counteract some assumptions that they're clearly making about you.
Yes.
Which is, like, you're definitely calculating, like, what do I think they think about me? I have to say something to assure them that that's not what's going on.
So I think that's a great instance. So where you're doing, let's say, a life history or a radio piece where you're working with someone over and over, the longer you spend with someone, the more ethical questions are going to come up, inevitably. And you are going to tread this fine line because you have a relationship that goes beyond the interviewer-interviewee relationship. I think there is some degree of impulse. I do think that sometimes having a third person with you as tech person can help. And especially like when you're saying, I don't always want to run the tech and, you know, work on that interpersonal relationship. So sometimes I have a silent tech person as third person, and it can keep it the right amount of formal. And I'm not trying to distance myself. I just really want the interviewee to have that experience. And if you ever transcribe an oral history interview, and this, again, might be a difference between a journalistic interview, you should see on the page that the question would be like this, and the answer would maybe like run a full page. And that is normal. And if you're seeing QA, 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 it's too journalistic. So an oral history interview, the person is ideally they're stream of consciousness talking. They're not worrying about being very efficient, which you do have to be with expensive film, or if you know you're cutting it for a radio doc. There are a lot of great instances of oral histories that have been turned into radio documentaries, and I would love to share, if for those of you who are interested in taking oral histories and turning them into radio, or doing oral histories with an eye toward radio, or ear toward radio, I put my contact information on these sheets, and I'd be happy to send you links to great radio pieces that have been made from oral history. There are also great oral history collections that you could be making radio doc from. I would love, with the remaining time, and to do a little exercise, because I think that we'll have more to talk about after we try some of this ourselves. And it's a really simple exercise, but I think it's also a humbling one, because most of us probably think we're already doing all of this. So what I'd like to do is to break into groups of three. And what we're going to practice is the life history component. And you're going to pretend that we're doing an interview about what's the subject, what's our project going to be, our hypothetical project. What might we all know something about? Or have feelings about? Ideas?
Food?
For this party? Okay. So how about if the project is about politics and food? And so that's the subject. You've approached people and you said, I noticed you're coming to this party, so I know you have something to say, or you might have an interest in politics and food. That person's coming prepared to talk about that. They might not come prepared to give you a life story, but your job is to say, before we get to the subject of politics and food, I'd love to know a little bit about you, so someone listening to this 20 years from now knows who the speaker is. So what we're gonna be doing right now is that beginning portion of the interview. So the reason we break into groups of three is that we're gonna have, in each group of three, one person volunteer to be the interviewer, one person volunteer to be the interviewee, and the third person's going to be the witness, which is a dramatic term for the person who just gets to notice everything. And that person should be writing everything down, including body language, the speed at which someone's talking, the moments when the interviewee seems like they're on autopilot versus actually like having revelatory thoughts. And what's working, what's not. The witness is also noticing roads the interviewer doesn't go down but could have gone down. So a lot of times as interviewer, we're trying to be, on the ball, and we get the next question ready and we forget to ask a follow-up question. So I'll repeat that list again, but I just have three volunteers. How many people? Oh, perfect. Could I have three volunteers, people who don't mind being interviewees, which means opening up a little bit to two other people about your life history? Of course, you're controlling what you reveal. Okay. What's your name?
Leanne.
Okay, so Leanne will be an interviewee. Who else doesn't mind answering the question, tell me a little bit about where you come from? What's your name?
Becca.
Okay, so Leanne, Becca, we need one more. Aaron. Okay. So basically, I would like one interviewer. Could I get three interviewer volunteers? Okay, tell me your name again.
Ryan.
Laura.
Okay, Ryan, Laura. We need one more interviewer. John. Okay. So why don't, you two pair up here. Ryan and Aaron, do you know each other? Okay, how about if Ryan and Becca pair up here, and Aaron and John pair up? So why don't we physically move around together, and then we'll place the witnesses, okay? And then I'll repeat what we're doing.
Do you videotape oral history?
Okay, good question. How many of you are interested in videotaping oral history as well as doing audio?
What do you recommend?
Okay, so I'm an audio person. I love the experience of listening to audio, and I like that my interviewees aren't worried about how they look. And I love that we can have this intense private experience physically, but that the audio will be transmitted and shared. But there are a lot of good reasons to do video. The Shoah Foundation debated about this for like several years before they hit upon that they would use video, and then they debated for months where the camera would be. So, and there are like whole plenary sessions on this kind of thing, where the video should go in oral history. So let's talk about that when we come back together. I think that's a really good question. So our interviewers and interviewees are together. You two are together. Okay. So, Tom, do you want to be a witness?
Sure.
Okay. And Dharma, do you want to be a witness here? Okay. And then tell me your name again.
Shelly,
why don't you join this group?
Okay.
And then Alex, you can be over here. I'll switch seats with you. Okay. So,
So
we'll have to be a little bit, I guess this will be a little bit hard in a contained space. But the witness should have a pen and paper or something to write with. Do you guys have that? Okay. So basically what's going to happen when we start is that you're really going to take nothing for granted, so pretend that we all don't know what we're, I mean, you do know what you're doing, but I really do want you to start with the, you know, so today what I'd like to do is talk about food and politics. Before we get into that, I want you to practice that thing. You know, before we get into that, I'd like to know a little bit about you, the interviewee, so that, and then explain why. And you can explain it in your own terms, and maybe you have another reason than the one I'm offering. I often say it's because I want someone to know, to be able to contextualize this interview. And that's really true. I mean, what good is an interview? We just know a person felt this way, but who is this person? So you're practicing justifying the life history, and then you're going to ask a question. And I'd like you to experiment with your own open-ended question. It doesn't have to be where do you come from. It can be tell me your earliest memory. It can be tell me about your childhood. You're just going to ask an open-ended question, and then you're going to proceed from there for about, we'll do it for, let's say, 10 to 12 minutes, okay? And the interviewer is going to try and ask open-ended questions that make the interviewee talk a lot. Every interviewee is different, and you guys who are interviewees, do not make their jobs easy. Don't make their jobs hard, but you do not, just be yourself, because anything we observe is going to be useful. So I would like to be able to come back as a group and have the interviewee say, I didn't want to keep talking when this kind of question was asked. So witnesses, these are the things you should be noticing, and your pen should basically not stop moving the entire time. You should be noticing questions that yield a lot of a long response, questions that stop the interviewee cold. You should be noticing body language. You should be noticing when the interviewer and interviewee seem comfortable or uncomfortable. And these won't be criticisms, it's just observations.
And we should probably note the question, like, as quickly as possible, you know, it's about ice cream. Ice cream question, stop her cold.
Yeah, just so that your group, you can talk about it. And it's very cold in the spring. So questions that seem effective, not effective, comfort, discomfort, body language. And the other thing that's really interesting when you're transcribing is the speed with which people talk. So when are people talking really quickly? When are they slowing down? So I think that's enough. Anything else you notice is, you know, gold, so go ahead. But are there any questions about what witnesses are doing? Okay.
Is it okay with you guys if I type?
So does anyone have any questions, interviewer, interviewees? Okay, and you guys might want to huddle even closer if it's possible, because I know there's going to be a lot of cross talk. Okay, so go ahead and begin.
What's your name?
I'm Laura.
Laura.
Begin.
Laura, Aaron?
Leanne.
Yeah. What's
your name? Tom. Should we be sitting on the same level as the person interviewing?
Physically?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah.
I can also get a chair if you're more comfortable.
That's
chair.
Okay.
And you're interviewing?
I'm interviewing.
Like I didn't know where you're going to go. That's fine.
We might want me to identify
myself. Are we ready?
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Hi, I'm Laura.
Hey, Leanne.
Hey, Leanne. I'm here today because I'm really interested in talking to people about food and politics and their relationship to those ideas.
It's really intriguing.
And I thought you might be someone who
could
share some. So you're that's okay?
Yeah,
interested.
Tell me
before we get into that subject,
yeah,
I'd really love to know a little more about you,
so,
where you come from, and your history.
So before we get
as a way to give a context and a lens to your ideas and sharing. So, can you start by just telling me a little bit about your background and start wherever?
Sure. Well, Leah, I'm 24 years old, and I grew up in Long Island, New York. Although now I've been living in New York City for the past 6 years. A little bit about where I grew up or what I'm doing now. Or
yeah, tell me a little more about where you grew up.
Okay.
That was
sure. Well, I grew up in a suburb of New York City. I grew up, my mom commuted into the city every day. She left to catch the train. And my dad was a mechanic and a gardener. And so I always grew up with a big garden behind the house. He worked out of the house, so I was there with him a lot.
He worked a lot.
When I was 10, my mom got married to a different person, and we moved to another town, another suburban town. And
it's food of interest, or
that town is beautiful.
What was your connection to German?
Did you still have a relationship with your father?
My old father passed away when I was 6 years old.
Yeah, but I mean, really, the parents had kind of heard stories.
So, Long Island, I have never been
Well, it's in like the commuter zone in New York City, or most of it is. So, a lot of people work in the city and go back and forth. But kind of like small suburban towns, and then they're cut up by like highways and strip malls in the middle. And then there's like beaches and stuff, but that's nice.
Yeah,
it's normally like the beaches. So it's kind of like a beautiful place to grow up in some ways, but also kind of boring.
You have to let me
as a kid, she doesn't have much like cultural activity going on.
So that's been really fun.
So our hobby was like walking, walking around for hours and hours.
Those stories about it.
Or driving around.
There's a lot more happening here.
Do you feel really? Do you feel like that's really connected to that place?
Yeah.
That's where I'm from.
Do I feel connected to or that side of
life?
The place.
I was really surprised.
Sure, in some ways I'm a product of it. It's not a place that I choose
to
live, you know, in the future probably. But that's sort of a combination of factors, probably financial.
Otherwise, I'm sort of like fighting all
but
I would have treated like
a question. I love going back to visit, but I don't know that
like
I would choose to live there.
Your perspective was
and the memory.
My entire family might be moving.
When you woke up this morning, you knew
so
there wouldn't
the
really be much of a
reason.
Yeah.
The landscape in your head.
Of what I remembered about this
Could you talk a little bit about in real time growing up?
Sure.
I imagine less.
Well, when my dad was alive,
I was just like
ate pretty well, at least in the summertime. I was like, he's from an Italian family, so the food was pretty successful.
She
was
loved to have
access to it. He just grew up with a lot of like food in his house. After that, we were like getting sick, and my mom was just raising us, and like we'd all at these like ramen noodles and like takeout and just like fast stuff because there wasn't so much demand. But then, I don't know. We definitely try to eat together most of the time. Although I've noticed, I'm one of five kids, so lots of time. And I've noticed, like, later down the line, now there's, like, only the last two living at home.
the family meal time is kind of dissipated all together and everyone's like fending for themselves. So I don't know where exactly that shifted, but certainly when I was growing up, we just made an effort at least to talk.
So if I was to define it to A.
What about school? What kind of school did you go to? Did you go to school?
Yeah, I did. I did go to just
what you eat,
the public elementary school
in
my first town. Or when I was really little, I went to Montessori school with like nuns and stuff. And then just more recently, like, the little child just, like, went around the left home for the first time, so that was also, like, a big turning point in the family, because, like, I have this feeling that my mom thinks it's, like, over, the family's over, because, like, most of the kids are out of the house, and now there's only two, which, like, for most people, like, is their family, but for her, she's like, this isn't enough. So we're in, like, a kind of transitional state right now. Interesting to watch, like, not living here myself, but just kind of like seeing how your feelings around it are changing.
Can you talk
some
about when you're at this collective farm here?
Mm-hmm.
So when I was supposed to for a while too.
So it's maybe a big assumption that
so you've been working today.
Had an interest
in the kitchen. And then at some point I was paying
her.
That's
probably true.
Could you talk to them about how you maybe found yourself to be connected to this place or the people that you're not here? And how
felt
triggers significant things you learned that drew you in this direction?
There was actually this week.
Well, I met some of the people that were here
in the kitchen.
I started going to college
Shelley
a few years ago.
I'd
always been involved in my
Shelley
culture,
and
just kind of joking, like organizing things,
and
mostly like I'm more of a neighbor on the level. And then I decided to go to school.
I will sit there and talk to
some
students.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was like looking for a way to be involved still, but like in the student kind of way, I guess. And so I got involved with an organization called the Student Farm Worker Alliance. And after working with them for a while, I went with like two. They have like a national gathering every year of their network. And
just
there is where I met Ashley, who lives here.
And Shelley
was so great. It was really close by. And I came up for a visit and just got to check out the place. And I don't know, just kind of like, I love the Hudson Valley a lot. And I was able to work up here last summer. So
it's sort of a little starlight ball thing. It's easier to
get to know everybody a little
more.
And then this past year, I went to Cuba with Ashley and Kyle, who also lives here.
Yeah, just
so
there were two places
that I guess my relationship to
the family was either Skid Bowling Alley, where my parents had their wedding.
Are you still in
Starlight Ballroom?
I have a year left.
Country work.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still doing study with
anthropology and sociology.
I just have what I remember about the place from the wedding for other Polish wedding.
How do you feel about living in the city with your interest in food?
It's a little rough sometimes. It definitely is. The past,
I
think 2 years ago, I left for the summer and did a farm apprenticeship, and then this past summer
I
worked on my
uncle's
farm.
But I was also half
in
the years and most of
so I try and like balance it out and just like leave for periods of time every once in a while because it's like hard to
just
like
one more minute
appreciate the natural world but be living in like a huge metropolis and like not see the There's also some really interesting like urban agriculture projects also that are really cool to learn about.
Well, there's more time.
What's going on,
so is Long Island Does it have enough green space?
So I'm going to do something that is so against the rules of oral history, which is interrupt, and I apologize. But I want to make sure we have time to talk about it. So let's. You can sit wherever you are.
Thank you.
If you moved around. How'd that go?
Great.
I would love to hear first from witnesses. So, and I heard a bunch of just interesting snippets, and because I couldn't hear content always, I could hear more sort of velocity and whether there were silence or not. So I would love to hear from witnesses what you observed first. So who was a witness?
Processing. I think I didn't look up enough as much as I could have because I was trying to write down, like, keep up with questions. It's really hard. But I noticed that Becca, you looked up when it seemed like a question was becoming interesting to you as you were talking. Like, you were listing what your favorite foods were, and then you said pesto, and you looked up. I thought that would have been, I feel like that may have triggered things about, like, preparing food and, like, why you know, I wanted to know why you like that. And that would have maybe something I would have seized on, because I felt like when you were talking, you gesticulated a lot with your hands and looked down, and then when you look up, I would have been like, what can I ask to get her to elaborate in this one part? But that would have entailed me kind of interrupting, which Ryan didn't do, which was good. What else?
What about silence instead of interrupting? What if you want someone to go further, just not asking anything else?
Well, I feel like you didn't stop talking at the places where you were saying something that was more interesting to you, then it would kind of peter out to being more perfunctory, like just kind of like trying to think of more things. I'm sorry, I'm being really judgmental, but like you would like, there would be a high point of like what was most interesting to do. The silence came after a lot more talking. I don't know if that's accurate. But questions. I can't really read my meter. I thought this is something I realized with my own questioning and speaking style in general. I do a lot of false starts. And Ryan does some false starts too. And I think that's something that sometimes the more direct and comfortable your question comes out, the better for the person to answer. And that's a really hard thing to do. The way I talk is like, you have to like have this new way of talking where you just kind of have a very simple thing that you say and just let it. And that's something that I noticed to like take them out. Even with like, you say, we're there, what? How did you, and then you get the question, it's like, great, but there's like some jogging in the front that maybe makes the answer that you get back kind of too. I don't know, assurance in questioning.
I don't know if anyone noticed this, but one thing that I also do a lot of peer review where I listen to interviews, and a lot of times people ask two questions together because they're worried the interviewee doesn't like the first one. So they'll say, tell me about your childhood. I mean, tell me, and then they say something else. I mean, tell me about your childhood. I mean, tell me where you come from. Tell me what, and you have to, you know, less is more because sometimes you're asking two questions to give opportunity, but you can give opportunity by asking a simple question. Did you have more you wanted to say before I ask Becca how it felt? Becca and Ryan, how did it feel?
I felt like it was really challenging for me, and so I was having a hard time thinking of questions or like disassociating.
Did you feel, because this idea of food and politics was like burning on our brain a little bit, we hadn't even been talking about it, but it had been presented as an idea, how was it hard to stay away from that and just do a life history before you got to food and politics?
Mm-hmm.
Becca, how did it feel for you?
I felt awkward and blabbery, and like I tend to think of myself as someone who sometimes can be very articulate, but in this context I really was just more over the place, and I felt like I was kind of trying to reassure Ryan sometimes,
mm-hmm.
which I think a lot of interviewees do, sort of.
Definitely.
Like. And I forget your name, but I was looking at you a lot, which was a little odd, because you were just supposed to be a witness. Yeah, I felt, yeah, and then we just went into food politics pretty quickly, which I was surprised by, but I was fine with talking about this. And there were some things that could have been picked up on that we didn't really go with, but I wasn't, that were interesting to me, but
mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure if, and I could see that as an interviewee, I was intentionally injecting something new in particular. I was kind of putting clues, like, go, follow this thread.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can guarantee that you feeling all over the place is exactly how your interviewees feel and will feel.
Mm-hmm.
And it is especially surprising. I don't know, any of the other interviewers, too. I think it's harder than we think it is, especially because we all do some kind of interviewing, but this is a particular kind, and it is very open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
So we're used to asking more finely focused questions.
Mm-hmm.
I also cheated you all of the opportunity, the breakthrough moment when the beginning turns into the middle. So what's interesting is that you just got to the tension, and then the tension breaks, and that's a very interesting moment in an interview. So we were talking about when the beginning becomes the middle. And I don't know if anyone experienced that yet, but it's probably very early to experience that. So this tension is part of the interview. It's significant. It's important. It shouldn't not be there. Anything you guys want to say before we open it up to other groups?
I had another quick realization.
Yeah.
And just because I noticed it because it's something that I had trouble with, is I noticed you talked about being a vegetarian and vegan,
mm-hmm.
and in your question afterwards, you used the term restrictive diets. And I don't know if
mm-hmm.
this is the right diagnosis
mm-hmm.
of that, but if I had done that kind of term substitution, what I would have been doing is trying to show myself as an expert or someone in the know to my interviewee, because I want, because I'm a person and I want like them to know that I'm smart and that I care about it too. But really, maybe the better thing is to like just use their language and not
mm-hmm.
just be like, yeah, I'm dumb. Like, be willing to just be like, I know nothing. You tell me. Like, you just
yeah,
say
that
what
was
they
definitely
say.
A moment when I felt like I was tripping on myself and I like, wasn't sure what to say, and I was like.
That's something you
yeah.
do in a conversation.
But
yeah.
I'm glad
like
that happened, because that happens a lot, and I think that's why you want to remember, and this is, you don't have to say it this formally, because it's incredibly just dorky, but in like oral history training, you often say, for the sake of the future historian, will you tell me blah, blah, blah. So like, you can use whatever words you want, but if she mentioned a vegan diet, instead of you saying, oh, I know what a vegan diet is, you want to say, for the sake of someone listening to this 20 years from now, tell me about that diet.
Mm.
So it really is, and having a little recorder in between you, the recorder serves as that audience, and sometimes it helps to remind you that there's a whole
yeah.
hypothetical audience out there.
It's like for the tape,
yeah.
that's what we were
yeah.
trying to say. It's like,
yeah,
explain what that means for the tape.
Yeah, for the sake of someone listening to this, however you feel comfortable stating that. But
yeah.
I think that's really important, because you are trying to connect, and we're so used to connecting based on the things we both know or agree upon, but you don't want to leave out your audience. But I'm glad that came up.
Mm-hmm.
Can I hear from you guys? Dharma, were you the witness?
Mm-hmm.
So what did you observe?
Well, the interview, they definitely went from beginning to end. There was an end and a wrap-up at some point when you said they called a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Then John was like, or they both sort of decided, you know, and John had a good wrap-up, like, okay, we're done. Like, he had a final kind of question to sort of put the end on. They had, there was a real energy match that I felt between them. So there was a lot of smiling and laughing happening back and forth, and eye contact, and mirroring of body movement.
You were kind
even
of
meeting a little bit.
Just, yeah.
Like, you were sitting together, sort of like, you're sitting this way and you were sitting that way, but it was sort of like a mirror image kind of thing
mm-hmm.
that was happening.
Can I buy your hat?
The pace was pretty much the same through the whole thing, there's kind of a sort of relaxed and somewhat hesitant pace that I guess would probably be like the beginning of the interview thing. We're kind of checking each other out and establishing that we want to be nice to each other and things. And then there's I think really just maybe almost towards the end, maybe we were pushing to the middle when Erin picked up her pace a little bit and started talking about that. And then I noticed, John, several times, you were pulling, I thought, the questions into sort of the more personal territory around the subject, or, you know, bringing up to, she mentioned something about in the content about, well, when I came up to the driveway, it reminded me of my, you know, when at home in Wisconsin going to weddings, and it's like, oh, that's interesting to me. And sometimes just repeating a word or two that she said,
mm-hmm.
and being like, oh, the Starlight Ballroom, that's interesting, you know, oh. You know.
Then she would keep going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Erin and John, what did you guys, how did it go for you?
Well, the thing that I love about it and that I love about this kind of interviewing is that it's just so surprising where it's going to go. You just never know where the conversation is going to end up, and it's just this like magical looping that takes you to all kinds of memories, and I thought you did a good job. You know, you kind of got me to go back and talk about things more, and I kind of was thinking about, you know, we had talked about this idea of food, and I was kind of, you know, throwing in stuff in there because I was just aware that that was what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So I was maybe leading my stories in those directions or throwing in stuff about that. But yeah, I thought like a lot of the questions were really good and open-ended, like what, you know, crazy questions I never would have thought of, like what was your experience coming into the driveway this morning,
mm-hmm.
to this place, and that
is
just...
I completely made that up, is that fair?
I think that's great, because
yeah,
it's a question
so
she
open.
Can't fail at, it's subjective,
yeah.
and she's becoming the authority.
And his questions tended to be like that. They were open-ended, but they were very grounded in real details. So I don't know if that's good or not, but...
I mean, I think what you want to think about the life history component, and, you know, I wish we had even more time to talk about this, but what you want to think about is what kind of information will be useful. So if you are doing a, you know, project on food politics, what would you want to know about your interviewees? And would you want to know information about region, class, religion? What kind of things would you want to know? And then how do you circle those subjects? You're not going to get to all of them, but you want to have some awareness of what ideally your interviewees, how you would profile your interviewee. And asking those questions, though, is fine because you are getting a profile in a sense, and you are getting character. You do want to make sure you pin them in time and space to something. And history is always good for that. But if we had more time, we could sit and make a list of what exactly would we want to know about our interviewees if they were about to talk about this subject. That's the kind of brainstorm you want to do if you're interviewing someone. But I did see, it's really amazing because watching you two talk, I didn't even know what you were saying, but I could tell there was rapport there, and I feel like it's amazing. Sometimes you'll ask the best questions and there isn't rapport. Sometimes you ask the worst questions and there's an amazing rapport. You never know what's going to happen. Some interviewees are fragile and some aren't. And I couldn't hear exactly, but I could see. I could see the rapport. I want to hear from this group before I say a few more things. So witnesses, we had two witnesses in this group. How'd it go?
See, I also felt like I had a hard time like watching what was going on because I was just trying to listen to what you were talking about. So like at the beginning I'm like writing down that they shook hands and from then on I didn't see much of the body language. But the pace of it felt really consistent throughout, and there was like only one point kind of towards the end where there was like the questions got a little less open-ended, like, are you still in school, that kind of thing. But mostly they were pretty open, about, like, tell me more about your family, or tell me more about, like, where you grew up in Long Island and that kind of thing, and turning points in your life, and, which Leanne was able to kind of keep talking about in the library?
That's a great question. Tell me about turning points in your life. That's a great question because it's broad. The follow-up question, the question, are you still in school? So how long was that answer?
Yes.
Okay.
So, but sometimes you want to know these little things like that. So sometimes what I do, I never come with questions. Sometimes I'll come with a timeline, a historical timeline, if it's like about an event. But usually, you know, you have like a piece of paper, and I'm just going to show you right now while we're here. I'll sit here. Let's say, Tom, you're my interviewee. Basically, Tom would be here, and I would be here, and I always use the corner of a table. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I want my table, like, nothing on it. Like, I'm just here, and it's just you, me, and the recorder. I do have a piece of paper here, and it's either blank, or there's like a date, 1935, that I want to ask someone about. But basically, if Tom says something and I don't want to interrupt him, but I want to come back to it, I'll make a note and I'll just say, like, you know, wild pigs. Like, I'm going to get back to that. So in this case, about getting back to school, you might want to say, tell me about your life now, or tell me about your responsibilities now.
And why is the corner important?
Oh, so the corner is important. This, I promise, although you, I don't know if you have a different experience, this is the best physical setup because you have enough, you're tethered to the recorder, and I found that people are free to move, but you're still looking eye to eye. It's better than being across the table, in my experience, and I promise that if you're on a sofa, you're going to be sorry within like 10 minutes. I also don't recommend drinking beer, wine, because essentially after a few glasses, like everything that's said, there are all kinds of ethical questions about loosening up your interviewee. And there are some people who really insist they want a beer, and I'm like, can we drink that after? But this is my favorite setup, and I wrote on the kind of pages I handed out, I wrote a few different examples of setups. Like, sometimes I've seen people use two mics into a laptop, two lavaliers right into a laptop, a digital recorder, an iPod with a mic. Those are just a few possibilities. WGXC has some equipment, is that right? Yeah. Okay, so that was just a little segue from this question about what to do if you do want to know a little something, but you don't want to interrupt the flow. So sorry to interrupt your list. Okay. And Tom, what about your observations?
Well, it's actually good because I did write down a lot about their hand gestures and their body language. So we didn't plan that at all. But you guys made excellent eye contact, it seemed like, from the beginning. We're really looking at each other. And I have a question about both asking questions and answering questions, and like I'm doing now, they both use their hands a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They were punctuating like I'm doing, you know, bring that. At one point you did a quotation mark thing. So is that helpful? I mean, first, eye contact, I assume, is like a real helpful thing.
Yeah.
And then what about hand gestures?
Well, hand gestures are a good sign because I feel like people are embodying what they're saying and they're not on autopilot. They're gesticulating, and usually that's some emphatic motion. But the thing that is sometimes tragic about things like air quotes is that you have to remember to put them in the transcript because you can hear maybe someone saying so-called, but you can't necessarily, the transcript, sometimes sarcasm or things like air quotes don't read. So I like to sometimes make a note of some body language. And I always, after I interview someone, and I ask my students to do this too, I make them, as soon as they leave, write a reaction. And in the reaction is all information that's not contained in the audio record. The way they felt emotionally, physically, the temperature of the room, other sounds, and like things like air quotes or, you know, body language.
The other thing, like you mentioned the school question, that was answered with a one-word answer, but a few moments before that you asked, what about school? Which was a wide-open question, and it led her to her telling a great story about, I think, a nun or something. that it was, like, really good. And then I also, one thing I noticed was that typically you would answer a question kind of in a short burst, very fast, and then you would kind of pause and look up and then expound, or, you know, you would have this moment to think about how you wanted to go into it more, but the first reaction to whatever question would be a short, and that, I would guess that's kind of typical, probably.
That's why that silence, it really is golden. Like, the fact that you didn't, like, insert yourself after the short answer is very important. That's great, because you get the long version.
Can I say a few things about eye contact?
Yeah.
I think one thing that's a big, can be a big barrier when you're interviewing is if at the beginning the subject is looking up and you're not looking back at them. Because the subject, I'm sorry to use, that's the word, the person, like, they're probably going to be talking and maybe not looking at you the whole time, but if they look up and you're not looking up, they're probably not, like, what you want to do is like, make something where there's more and more eye contact until you're just talking, like, right into your face.
Yeah.
And with the memory thing, like, there's some study that I think is really valid about when people look up, depending on which direction or down they're looking, it's which part of memory they're accessing or whether they're doing calculations. And, if you pay attention to that, you know not to interrupt someone. Like, if they look up, or if they're just looking down, it's like they're trying to think of an answer for you, but they're looking up, they're actually going into their memories.
Hmm.
So yeah, the not interrupting part, because someone is, like, clearly searching and, like, talking while they're searching, but they're not, like, looking at you and just relating yet.
And people can endure so much silence. I mean, we think it's not endurable, but what's the worst that's gonna happen? If someone's looking up and they're maybe gonna say something, just stop. I mean, really count to three. How did you guys feel about silence and pausing?
I didn't notice that much silence myself, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I noticed afterwards that I didn't leave much silence, and that's been my way in the past of drawing out, is when someone stops to let them know I'm really listening by asking another question, and that's I need to practice opening up space instead of asking another question.
I would bet we all need to practice that, including me in this room. It's something that if you just listen to your interviews and you realize you could have been quiet for so much longer, but it's very frightening at the time because you think it's not polite to the person you're talking to. But if you force yourself to count to three when you think you're about mm-hmm. to begin again, it's one way of training. How did you guys feel?
I felt good. I had a lot of the same feelings with, I don't remember your name, but just, like,
yeah,
kind of like the way that memories flow together. And I think, like, a lot of times that there could be silence, I was, like, scanning through this, like, memory database or something, and I'm like, what would be interesting to say? Or, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't know. But also it made me think about, you know, as, you know, I'm more often, I guess, the interviewer, and just thinking about how important it is to be a trustworthy person. And, like, you know, within, like, 5 minutes, I'm, like, sharing, like, my whole, like, family history and this and that, which is fine, but, just to, like, I don't know, just makes me want to be a better interviewer and just, like, make sure I it's an honor, really, to
it
be,
is.
Like, in that presence. So I think just to, like, keep remembering that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wish we had more time. I think we have so much more to talk about, including these questions that came up about reciprocity and video. But I just want to explain the rest of the sheet, even though we won't have time to go through it. So to just show you what I included, a lot of the things we talked about are on page 1 and the top of page 2. But what we didn't get to is just how to approach interviewees, some suggestions. I mentioned it a little bit, that you should tell someone who you are, why you're interested in it, where it's going. You know, err on the side of telling them everything. Some possible recording setups, places to share and archive interviews, websites, radios, radio, oral history archives, public library. You know, there's a lot of sound art being made from oral histories right now. And I'm happy to be in touch with you guys about more links to projects using oral history. And then I just wrote before, during, and after, reminders of what to do before an interview, during, and after. And I think those are important, so please take a look at them. And the very last page, because some of you are interested in learning how to do an oral history interview, and some of you are interested in planning projects, this is exactly what you would need. This is how to design a project. So if you're thinking more in terms of a set of interviews, these are the questions you would need to answer. And if you just go through it like a worksheet, you would basically have a project design. So that might or might not be relevant for everyone right now. But thank you so much for going through all of this. And I've never been to the farm, so I'm really happy to be here. Yeah.
Thank you.
And if you I'm sticking around. If you guys have any questions, feel free to ask.
Hey, did you say this before, but where do you teach at?
The New School, University in the city.
So I'm going to go get the some CD playing on so we won't be on the air anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So let me do that for just a second. And you're listening to WGXC Online Radio, and we're going to play some more Alexander Turnquist, a different CD than earlier. And if you're on the farm, dinner's going to be ready soon. So go have some food.